Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 12, 2007. Let the record reflect we have a quorum. We have a number of the broadcasting items today, and for members, these items are located in your budget books under the Department of Administration. You may have a tab that says Public Broadcasting, and there may not be anything there, but if you look in the budget books on page 83, starting with 83 and following, those are the budget areas for the broadcasting things we're going to be looking at today. We'll start with the Minnesota Public Television area, and who is here? Mr. Straczynski? Welcome to the Budget Division, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Straczynski, and I represent the interest of the Friends of Minnesota Public Television, have done so since 1983, so I'm honored to be here today, and thank you for taking committee time to listen to us. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just want to point out a couple of things. What we're going to talk about is two budget initiatives, which unfortunately the governor did not decide to fund, and so therefore they're not reflected in your budget books. One of them is our digital television initiative, which there will be legislation coming forward, specifically a bill on that subject, $14 million to help us finish off the digital interconnection, the digital build-out of our facilities and our interconnection. In addition to that, Mr. Chairman, members, we've had a request for an increase in our operational grants of $500,000 per year, or $1 million for the biennium. Basically takes us back to pretty close to where we were about 6-7 years ago. Mr. Chairman, with that, to do a digital demonstration, I'd like to introduce Dan Thomas. Dan is with the Chief Operations Officer for Twin Cities Public Television. You can talk about that particular initiative if it's okay with the Chair.
And please be advised that the members who are on the Budget Division have not had previous experience in the last 2 years at least or more on this Budget Division, so we may not even be familiar with what the FCC requirements are and so forth, so somebody may want to at least describe why it's necessary to do this. But anyway, please welcome to the Budget Division and identify yourself for the record.
Good. Thank you, Chair Betzold and Senators. My name is Dan Thomas, as Mr. Straczynski mentioned, and next to me is Bill Sanford from Lakeland Public Television. And we'd like to start, as Mr. Straczynski mentioned, we do have two requests before you, both related to digital television. And we'd like to start by telling you a little bit about our digital channels and how we're using them. And I want to start out by, first of all, thanking you, because in 2001, the state of Minnesota granted about $8 million to the Minnesota Public Television stations in order to meet a federal mandate to convert to digital broadcasting. So we have finished that phase of our digital conversion. We are all on the air with digital broadcasts. Those digital broadcasts are available over the air and via cable. To give you a better sense of what you helped fund, with the Chair's permission, I'd like to go over to the demonstration there and walk you through it.
Yep. Well, Mr. Chair, while he's doing that, how many public television entities are there in the state? Do we know that, or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are six public television stations belonging to the association, and those six stations have several towers, transmitters, and transponders. And so geographically, we cover about 95% of the population of the state of Minnesota. So we have stations in Bemidji, Fargo-Moorhead, Duluth, Austin, Twin Cities, of course, and Appleton.
Does that include the Granite Falls area?
It does, Mr. Chair.
It does, okay. Mr. Thomas.
Yes. Well, what I want to start by pointing out to you is an analog television set. Now, this happens to be an old analog television set. It's a black and white. Many of us in our homes probably have color television sets with antennas and receive free over-the-air television. In fact, in the state of Minnesota right now, 20% of the citizens still receive their television over the air for free. Obviously, with cable, we have many other choices. Again, I want to emphasize that the digital channels that we have on the air are both available over the air for free, as well as available via cable. The other thing I want you to understand just visually is this is one program service in an analog world. In a digital world, we can have multiple program services. So you see here a full-time high-definition channel that TPP has on the air right now. Next down is the full-time children's channel, CBC Kids. The smaller monitor at the end there is a full-time local service channel called the Minnesota Channel. That one happens to be fed by a set-top box. These are being received, these signals are being received over the air. Again, any of these channels can be received either way. There's a fourth program service on this laptop here, which is called TPT Create, a lifelong learning service for adults. This one happens to be received because there's a digital tuner plugged into a laptop. Some people, younger people, like to watch television on their computers. This makes it possible to receive over-the-air digital signals and display them on a computer. So, again, you're seeing multiple channels here all being broadcast simultaneously. It means that in a metro home, a kid can be watching educational programming, the best educational programming available through PBS on TPT Kids, at the same time that an adult is learning more about what's going on in their local area, including state government. That happens to be your legislators, produced by Pioneer Public Television, that's on the Minnesota channel right now. Or someone could be watching the lifelong learning channel called Create. And of course, you could be watching high definition PBS and local shows on this high definition service. So the other thing that you might notice here is that all of these digital channels are of a much higher quality than what you get over the air with analog. All of the interference that you have with analog is not there in digital. Again, available free over the air or via cable. The TV sets that are being sold today, the larger ones, all have digital TV tuners built into them. They can receive these signals over the air without purchasing anything else. All television sets will have digital TV tuners built into them starting in March. As Mr. Straczynski mentioned, we are all on the air with digital broadcasting, and I think the number is 97% of the citizens of the state of Minnesota can receive one of the six Minnesota public television stations with over the air. The key message here is really that we're dramatically expanding the services that we're providing to the citizens of Minnesota. The other thing we know about the citizens of Minnesota is that they highly value public television. The number of people who tune in to one of the six Minnesota public television stations every month is 2 million. 2 million people turn to public television every month. That's more people being served more often than any other public institution. So if there are any questions about what you're looking at here, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I'll go back to talk about our capital request.
Any questions on the hardware? Okay, watch it. You'll need to get nearer to a mic, obviously, for any further questions.
So we do have two requests in front of you. One is an increase in our operating support that Mr. Sanford will talk about. I'm going to talk about our capital request. And this is a request to help us complete our digital conversion. We know that consumers are adopting high-definition television, and the rate is increasing rapidly. About 20% of the homes across the country have high-definition television sets currently. More and more, that's all that's being sold. We have, of course, focused up until now on the conversion of our digital transmission. We were required by the federal government to do that. We needed to get on the air with that. But all along, we knew we had two more stages of digital conversion. One is production, and the other is interconnection. We need to build digital high-definition production facilities throughout the state, and we need to fund an interconnection system so that all the citizens of the state can have a full choice of the programming being created at each of the individual stations, and that the stations can exchange programs in an economical fashion. So the $14 million request, let me talk first about the production funding. The production facilities of the Minnesota Public Television stations, because we have been focused on transmission, are rooted in an analog past. They're rooted in a standard definition past where now, as you can see, a high definition is in a completely different picture ratio than the more square standard definition that we have been used to. As consumers adopt high-definition television at home, they rightfully expect that their communities will be represented fund those services with local programming of the same quality. So the funding that is being proposed here for production would enable every Minnesotan to be served by a public television station that has complete high-definition television facilities, including field cameras, studio switching gear, editing systems, videotape recorders, and video servers. Basically, what this will allow us to do is to create local digital programs for our local communities. The interconnection part of what we are requesting, it would be allowing us for the first time to allow all six stations to exchange their content in real time. One of the great advantages that this offers would be the statewide distribution of the Minnesota Channel. The Minnesota Channel is a project that TPT has been involved in for the past 4 years. We have been producing programs largely through partnerships with colleges and universities, with government agencies, with social service organizations, and we have put them together to make a full-time local channel. The other public television stations in the state are very interested in carrying it, and interconnection is the only way to make that possible. One of the
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, we'll see.
That interconnection, are you talking like fiber optic cable or satellite, or what kind of interconnection?
The interconnection is going to be based on the Minnesota Public Television stations utilizing the state's fiber optic network. And we are going to seek help with the operational costs of that, but the capital funding that I'm talking about is specifically going to provide fiber optic interconnection equipment for the stations. And for two of the stations that are not within the proximity of the state network, it will provide last-mile microwave connections.
What kind of program are we talking about that have to be interconnected that you cannot do now?
Right now, the only way that the television stations, public television stations in the state, can exchange programming is by shipping videotapes to each other. We do have satellite connections. We use those satellite connections sporadically for things like distributing Almanac to all the stations in the state. A real-time interconnection system would allow us, for instance, to make Almanac truly a statewide program by tying in studios across the state for live feeds into the show that's hosted in Minneapolis. It would also allow us to exchange programs like Venture North, which is produced up in Duluth, and transfer them through this fiber optic system rather than have the cost and the delays of shipping videotapes.
Mr. Chairman, let me just quickly elaborate. We have looked at, over the years, a variety of options, including satellite interconnection for those types we need it, as well as developing our own microwave system. Very, very expensive technologies. And this legislature, about 5 years ago, along with the Department of Administration, enacted legislation that allows public television to have access to the state's backbone system, which is the fiber links. And most of our facilities are very close to, as Mr. Thomas said, state facilities. So it's easy for us to make that interconnection. But the equipment's needed to do that. And that's the quick overview.
I do seem to recall some instances, as, for instance, on Almanac, where you have one of the hosts in Duluth or whatever for a convention. I mean, you use satellite technology, right, it's possible right now to have a remote report or location. It's just more difficult to do. Is that what you're saying?
It is possible. It has to be booked on an hour-by-hour basis. And
okay.
So, for instance, it makes it impractical or impossibly costly to do something like distribute to all the other stations a full-time channel like the Minnesota Channel.
I see. Okay. Go ahead.
The last thing I'd like to call your attention to related to the capital request is a spreadsheet that I hope you found with your materials today. And what this spreadsheet will show you is how the public television stations of the state were able to leverage the funding that we received in order to convert our broadcast facilities to digital. So in 2001, we were granted $7.8 million. There was another smaller grant that came to TPT. So the total, if you look at the column that says state grant, the total of capital funding from the state for digital transmission is $8.55 million. We were able to leverage that $8.55 million in in great ways. Most of the federal grants we apply for require a match. You can see that we were able to bring in another $12 million in federal grants and another $4 million in local funds. Those are funds from corporations or foundations in our communities. So total cost of $25 million, it was made possible for us to complete that transition thanks to the money that we got from the state that we were able to use then to leverage other fundraising.
Okay, and then...
And that is, okay. Concludes my remarks about the capital request. I'll take any questions.
And does Mr. Sanford have anything to add to that? Do you have any presentation?
Yes, I'd like to talk a little bit about the $500,000 operating increase.
Okay, well, let's see. Any questions on the on Mr. Thomas's part? Senator Olsen, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that public radio is the backbone for the emergency broadcast network. Are you guys in a similar role on the TV side?
Mr. Thomas?
Senator Olsen, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry.
A follow-up?
Go ahead.
Because it's it's easier in my mind to justify infrastructure spending on something like this if there's a public good out of it. With public radio, I see, you know, being the backbone for the emergency broadcast system, you know, so if you guys actually are, that would, for me, that means, you know, a pretty good value of investing public dollars because we're getting something out of it for everybody.
Well, we will be hearing from public radio next, but radio is cheaper and there's more of them than TV stations, so I think they're, you know, a bit different purposes here.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just let you know that I'll find out specifically the answer to that question, Senator Olson. I know we've had conversations with the Commissioner of Public Safety, for example, on how, if we're interconnected, how we can use our bandwidth and our capabilities to reach everybody in the state in case of homeland security issues, continuing education, training, even a fire service, all those kinds of people. We can do all those things statewide using our infrastructure and the capabilities of the Minnesota Channel. That's some of the beauty of all of this. And so we've had those discussions. We've had discussions and have had collaborations with several agencies to use our facilities. We've done in the past, it's very expensive because we had to use satellite technology and fiber optics, and microwave systems coming back in and phone lines a couple of years ago. But governors can broadcast and talk to everybody, have town hall forums, those kinds of things. And I think the best example to take a look at is Minnesota legislature. Today's session of the Senate was distributed to the public through Channel 17 locally. Future, with the right kind of interconnection and technology, we would have the technical ability to do that live statewide without using satellite, which you are currently using, to go to cable head ends around the state, so that people in Minnesota could receive, for example, watch the Minnesota legislature floor sessions if you want that. But to do that, the fact is people just have to turn on a television set. They don't need cable television to do that, although under the must carry rules, cable televisions have to carry our signals, so that's a federal law. So, I mean, there is a real benefit there, and then certainly can do live because we would be interconnected and do live statewide. That's a good example about how we look at see the technology. In analog, we had to interrupt Sesame Street or something to broadcast that. We don't have to do that in a new technology.
Sir Pappas, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I apologize I came in late, but there is both an operating request and a capital expense, in my understanding. And so will the capital expense, is that going to be referred to the Capital Investment Committee? For funding, you're not going to have any capital dollars.
No, I don't. Well, I'm not sure. So, Mr. Straczynski?
Mr. Chairman, there is a bill that will be introduced within a week dealing with this item, and it's one-time dollars, so I'm not sure where it's going to go to Capital Investment Committee or if this committee is going to be given discussions later on.
Okay.
This is for $14 million, one-time dollars for these grants to public television stations.
Okay.
Senator.
All right.
Other questions? Okay. Mr. Sanford?
Yes. I'd like to talk a little bit about the $500,000 increase in our operating funds, the request for that. Those dollars are really critical for the operation of the stations throughout the state. You know, I'm up in Bemidji, and we have a station that serves the Bemidji area and the Brainerd area. And we've seen since about 2000 our funding drop by over a third, our state dollars. And the thing that's really difficult about that is we receive some federal funding, too, and those federal dollars are based on what we receive locally and from the state. So when we lose dollars at any of those local levels, we take another hit from the federal government. So it's really impacted our operation. Lakeland provides a large area. We serve basically from the Canadian border down to Little Falls. And I'm going to tell just a little bit about our station. I think you're going to hear the same kind of story from the other licensees as well. But we serve a very rural area. We do a preschool outreach called Ready to Learn, and we provide over 50 workshops throughout our coverage area. And these are in some of the poorest counties in the state. And what we do is we work with preschool child care providers and teach them how to utilize our educational programming in positive ways to reinforce good behavior of the kids, reinforce things like sharing and how to deal with the loss of a parent, and just lots of important lessons. Also, Lakeland provides the only local news in our entire coverage area. As I said, we serve from basically from Little Falls to the Canadian border, and we do a nightly newscast that basically serves a very important need in that area. We did a lot of research before we started doing that, because it's kind of odd for a public TV station to be providing local news. And we were providing other types of programming prior to that, and the communities all came back and said, we aren't served at all with any local television news in this area, so we're doing that nightly. And that's kind of a stretch for us as well. But as I said, these operating funds are critical for us to be able to continue to provide these local services. Our funding has been cut pretty drastically. Even if we were to be granted this $500,000 increase, we would still be a little bit below where we were back in 2000. And that's not talking about inflation. That's just talking real dollars. So I think it would really help us to provide the services that we're going to need to provide. Lakeland is also doing the same thing with digital. We're broadcasting 6 channels throughout our coverage area. And one of the channels that we carry right now is the House and Senate, the Senate media feed. So people in our area with the digital television, we also feed quite a few cable systems with that as well, are able to pick up these proceedings throughout our area with our digital broadcasts. So we're providing a lot of important services in this area. We've had to make some staffing cuts to deal with some of the cuts that we've had. We've really tried hard not to cut any of our services, but we're about at the point where, you know, if we don't see some relief here before too long, we will be cutting some local services. And, you know, as far as our choices of what we can cut, you know, we kind of have to be a PBS member. That's the basics. And there's no kind of ramp-up way to do that. You're either a member or you're not. You've got fixed fees. You know, the only areas that we've got a lot of discretionary discretion over is the local services that we provide, the outreach services that we do, the local news. We did over 12 hours of live debates for House and Senate races in our area this past election cycle. So we're providing a lot of local content in that area. And I think that kind of talks a lot about it, but the increase would really shore things up for us and help us get back to where we were. As I said, it would also bring in some federal dollars as well, some additional federal dollars. So it would really help, especially the smaller stations who are operating kind of on a shoestring budget. And I'd be happy to take any questions about that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Sanford, you just identify what would happen if you did not receive the funding and some of the programming cuts. I don't think we asked Mr. Thomas now. What does this do to digital conversion if this doesn't happen this year? If the funding isn't provided for digital conversion, what are the ramifications? I mean, well, you can't do it, but what does that mean in the scheme of things?
Chair, if I understand the question, it's about the capital request.
So suppose you don't get money for digital conversion.
If we don't get the money for digital conversion, we will just continue to limp along with the production facilities we have, which are in various stages of antiquity. It means that we are able to do less in terms of providing local programming for our local communities. And without the interconnection, we cannot distribute the Minnesota Channel to all the citizens of the state. The Minnesota Channel, I think, because it is produced in partnership with so many public service organizations and government agencies, has a wonderful civic benefit to the citizens of the state, and so that would be a loss as well.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just also, the underpinning for all of this is the federal government mandated some years ago that all public television stations convert from that analog signal to digital. Currently, we have and by March of 2009, we have to send our analog license back to the federal government. That's been part of the Federal Budget Balancing Act for some time. That's a federal mandate. Currently, we are broadcasting with a digital technology through our transmitters as well as an analog technology. Very expensive. We have to do both until 2009. But there will be no analog transmissions after 2009. So the importance of these dollars is they need cameras, equipment, and whatever to continue with productions, to do productions in a digital age, because the analog technology just basically won't exist anymore.
Sir Olson.
Mr. Chair, that's where I'm having a problem, because I'm hearing you say that you're broadcasting digitally and analog, and you're saying you have to replace equipment, but aren't you using the new digital equipment at this time also?
The new digital equipment is by and large for broadcast. So it allows us to take digital programs we get from PBS and from other sources and rebroadcast them for the people in our communities. It does not give us, unless we get production facilities funding, we have a limited ability to create high-quality digital local productions.
We're just repeating the signal. In other words, Mr. Chairman, Senator, we're just repeating the we would be repeating a digital signal through our transmitters, but we cannot do local origination productions, nightly news, those kinds of things, which require local cameras, production equipment at the local level. It has to be digital, not analog.
You've given some examples, but how much is there a ratio right now that you can identify of how much of your broadcasting is done locally as opposed to feeds you get in from elsewhere?
Chair, I would not be able to put a percentage on that, but I would be able to say that what you see over there, the high-definition channel, comes from PBS. We do insert local high-definition programs where we can. For instance, we rented high-definition equipment and did a show with Bethel College over the holidays that was produced in high-definition and then broadcast in high-definition. What you see in the Minnesota channel there, much of it is produced with standard 4x3 cameras. In other words, that's the aspect ratio there versus the wider aspect ratio. What we would hope to be able to do is be able to produce all of our shows in high definition in the wider 16:9 aspect ratio.
Other questions regarding public television?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Straczynski.
I will find the number. At one time I had a number, I don't have it at my fingertips, about the amount of programming that's done at the local level, local originated programming. It was fairly significant. I'll find let you know how many hundreds of hours it is per year. I will make that information available. That information, I think, is available, and I'll make it available.
And if you identify some of the programming, too,
yes.
Some of the names.
And I wanted to let you know, Mr. Chairman, members, for those who are new to the committee, public television in a lot of states surrounding us, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, the Dakotas, public television is owned by government itself. Typically the higher ed community. So they're spending tens of millions of dollars on public television in those individual states as part of their operating budget. Tens of millions of dollars in each one of those states. In Minnesota, last time I looked, the per capita, but we were formed with nonprofit agencies, nonprofits, community-based public television stations, but basically we're doing the same thing. Our missions are similar to what your missions are in educating people and what have you. The last time I looked at the numbers, Minnesota ranked 46th per capita amount of dollars going to public television. So frankly, it's a very good bang for the buck if you're looking for that. Plus, all of our dollars are matched. Thank you for the committee's time.
Sure. Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Straczynski, you're not advocating that the state runs public television, are you, in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, no, I'm not, but I'm just showing you what a value it is compared to what it costs other state governments.
I think we get ourselves in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, thank you. And I just wonder if we could get the TVs turned off so they're not distracting us and the rest of me.
We went and watched.
Watching them. Kathy.
Watching the Teletubbies.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
We're talking about the stadium right now, Michael.
I'm watching the kids.
Oh, wow. Okay. Can we keep one or two on and turn off
this
the
is rest? Beautiful. Aren't they nice?
Okay, next we'll be talking about Minnesota Public Radio.
Okay, which one do you want to keep on?
No.
Okay,
welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Johnson with Minnesota Public Radio.
And I'm Vern Gooden with Minnesota Public Radio.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Betzel, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you information about Minnesota Public Radio and the important public safety services provided by MPR for all residents across the state.
Yes.
My name is Jennifer Johnson. I'm here today as a listener and an employee of MPR. With me is Vern Gooden. Vern is the district manager for our Moorhead station. Together, we hope to give you an overview of public service we provide for residents of this state. Minnesota Public Radio reaches approximately 800,000 Minnesotans weekly through our three radio services. They listen, on average, 8.5 hours a week. In greater Minnesota alone, 250,000 people listen to MPR each week. We have more than 350 employees across the state, and throughout the years, MPR has worked diligently to maintain, improve, and expand public radio service to greater Minnesota, where the population density is lower and fundraising is more difficult. From Thief River Falls, International Falls, Ely and Grand Marais in the north, to Albert Lea, Austin, and Worthington in the south. MPR has used its technical infrastructure across the state for important services in addition to our radio broadcasting. We play a key role in public safety for our residents. With its network of stations, MPR serves as the backbone to the state's emergency alert system, commonly referred to as EAS, and formerly known as the Emergency Broadcast System. MPR provides the signals in the event of an emergency or other disaster to all other radio stations, television stations, and other broadcasters across Minnesota. MPR also plays an important role in the safety of our state's most important resource, our children, by serving as the radio backbone to the state's Amber Alert System, providing the Amber Alerts, or our Child Abduction Warning System, to all other radio stations, television stations, and broadcasters across the state. MPR also provides the special subcarrier signals for a program called the Radio Talking Book. This is a reading service offered by the Minnesota State Services for the Blind. Since 1968, the Radio Talking Book service has broadcast readings of current newspapers, books, and periodicals for those unable to read themselves. In addition, MPR now serves as the sole backup network operations center for National Public Radio and our country's public radio satellite system. In the event of an emergency or a disaster in our nation's capital, this system is capable of quickly coming online to provide continuity for public radio stations all across the country. Radio is hardly the most cutting-edge technology, but it's still the most reliable way to broadcast emergency information. MPR started 40 years ago in 1967 at St. John's University in Collegeville as the tiny radio station KSJR. Today, MPR is an important arts and culture institution in our state. It also has the region's largest radio newsroom and has won more than 875 journalism awards. MPR offers listeners across the state access to three different services: news and information service, classical music service, and our newest service, The Current. All three of these services focus on public service radio programming. Audiences turn to MPR News for in-depth coverage of issues that affect them where they live. We have reporters across the state to cover issues that matter to our citizens. Public insight journalism is a new way for MPR journalists to find the best sources and the best information to inform our news coverage. The centerpiece of our public insight journalism initiative is our Insight Network, a group of thousands of Minnesotans who have agreed to help us cover the news. Every week, our journalists tap into that network, currently at more than 20,000 people in total, and these people share their observations, knowledge, and expertise with us. Our newsroom employees take that information, distill it, pass it on to reporters and editors. We believe that this relatively new approach to journalism adds significant diversity to our coverage and makes NPR an even more trusted and credible source of news and information. NPR is now the nation's largest producer of classical music programming. For decades, classical NPR has brought the music of local institutions such as the Minnesota Orchestra, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and specials of music from our local colleges and universities to audiences across the state and the nation who might not otherwise be able to listen to this type of cultural programming. Many large cities in the nation, in fact, do not have a radio station that offers classical music programming. But if you live in Worthington, International Falls, Grand Marais, or Albert Lea, all you have to do is turn on your radio for free and you have access to the same great programming available in Twin Cities. Our third regional service is The Current. Available now in the Twin Cities and Rochester by broadcast, The Current showcases local musicians and groups. It also encourages civic engagement among our youth with programs in collaboration with the Citizens League and other important local organizations. One event that The Current recently sponsored was called Rock the Cradle, a day of family, music, and community building that was held at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and the Children's Theater. More than 4,000 people, mainly young families with children, came to this free event last December. We partnered with the United Way, McPhail School of Music, and a number of other important community organizations. It's just one example of the unique service the station offers the community. Even where our services are not available on broadcast, either in Minnesota or across the world, they're available as live streams on the Internet. You can listen to all three NPR services on your computer any place in the world. Through our Internet streams and our national programs, we are one of the state's ambassadors. At NPR, we have also just started an extremely important undertaking, our Digital Archive and Online Access Project, to permanently catalog, preserve, and protect 30,000 hours of significant and fragile sound recordings before they deteriorate. This is 40 years of our state's oral history, including speeches, interviews, and important documentation of Minnesota events that we have covered since the inception of NPR. The final goal of this project will be to preserve and make available a vast audio resource for scholars, journalists, educators, and students. Thank you for your time and attention. Next, Vern Gooden will give you an overview of our capital needs and a little bit of history and background on our state appropriation.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Vern Gooden. I'm the station manager in Moorhead, Minnesota for Minnesota Public Radio. I've been employed by Minnesota Public Radio for 13 years, and I live in Moorhead. And I am pleased to provide you with a little bit of background on the state funding that we have received and what we will be requesting this time. NPR has used its state appropriation for capital purposes only to extend and improve and maintain our services in greater Minnesota, where it's often more difficult to raise the money needed to do that. NPR has used recently appropriated state funding to install broadcast signals in Hinckley and perform infrastructure improvements in Duluth, St. Peter, Rochester, Worthington, Bemidji, and Brainerd. The 2008-2009 appropriation request of $850,000 for the biennium would allow us to address a long list of projects in locations in need of new service or improvements to existing translator service. Communities on NPR's project list are, one of them is Rosa, which is in my district, so I'm pretty excited about that one, and War Road, where NPR recently acquired an FCC construction permit for a new radio station. 15 locations that are in need of a terrestrial backup for NPR transmitters. Buell, which needs a transmitter replacement, Fergus Falls, Grand Marais, Austin, and La Crescence, which all need backup power generators to reduce downtime, and Collegeville and Rochester, where NPR plans to install satellite uplinks to be used as emergency network programming hubs. Funding for replacement and repair of existing facilities around the state has become more crucial. It is likely that existing equipment at transmitter sites with a history of poor service will need to be replaced. There are also needs related to digital conversion, which is likely to be the industry norm in the near future. Though on a station-by-station basis, digital conversion for radio is less expensive than for television, for which this body provided $7.8 million grant in the 2002-2003 biennium, there are more public radio stations. We estimate the total cost of digital conversion for NPR stations alone will be about $6.9 million, of which we hope to receive $3.1 million in federal funds. To earn the entire federal match, we will have to invest $3.8 million in locally generated dollars. It is difficult to raise capital funds for projects outside of the Twin Cities. Consequently, NPR requests funding for this local portion. Some of the federal funds are on a short timeline, so this is a need that is present now. We are grateful for the public-private collaboration that has made Minnesota Public Radio what it is today. We look forward to expanding our mission of community service well into the future. Thank you for your time and attention. And both Jennifer and I are available and willing to answer any questions you may have for either of us.
It's my understanding that the governor has not made any recommendations regarding public radio. Is that in his budget proposals?
The base
budget, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Right.
And members, there wouldn't be anything in your books on it. Mr. Lundeen did prepare a spreadsheet so you can see what we have been spending on and what is, continuing the base budget for public radio. So are you saying that there's proposals that you have that are not covered by the base that you're seeking in this biennium?
Right. Our request for funding for capital for Greater Minnesota Projects is $850,000 for the biennium.
Okay. So that's not within the governor's proposal, so I don't know if there's going to be a separate bill introduced on that.
Yes.
But something would have to come before us
on
that. So, okay. Okay. And what is the base right now that, Mr. Lundeen, what are we spending right now for public television?
The base is $190,000 a year, or $380,000 for the biennium. So what NPR is asking for is a $470,000 increase for the biennium.
Okay. And as Mr. Gooden stated, this would only be for capital expenditures, not for operating, or is that?
That's true.
Okay.
Capital only. Oh, and in Greater Minnesota only.
In Greater Minnesota, okay.
Sure.
Senator Roebling.
I think I heard somebody mention that we might be able to pay cash for this, but have these requests typically gone to the Capital Investments Committee in other years when you had capital requests?
No.
Mr. Lundeen, do you know that?
When we provided funding for public television back, I believe it was 2001, that came through the state government budget division, and we made the appropriation there. And typically, the funding that we've given to Minnesota Public Radio has been done in this committee.
Would they be eligible to go through capital investment, or is the length of their equipment, or the life of their equipment, less than the 20-year bond would be, and then they'd be ineligible?
Yeah, I believe that would be an issue, the length of the equipment.
Mr. Bonner, did you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, there would be a requirement that be publicly owned. That's a constitutional requirement. I'm not sure if NPR would satisfy that.
That's right.
Okay. Other questions regarding public radio? Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, you guys have just recently had a very successful capital campaign drive, and I got to say, NPR is probably the most entrepreneurial public radio system in the nation, and I think you guys have done good things and been able to produce money amazingly. You had said something about, can you go back over the numbers on the federal portion of the conversion to digital? I thought it was $6.9
million. Right.
Mr. Gooden, or Ms. Johnson, who's, I'm sorry.
And the total was $6.9 million. The federal share of that was 3.1 million, so we need 3.8 million locally generated funds. Those are the funds we would request from the state.
How much of that do you plan on raising yourselves?
I don't have an answer for that one. I don't know. Do you have an answer, Jennifer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, the funds that we do not use any state funds at all for operating revenue. The fundraising we do is specifically for that, and part of the reason is we have a newsroom. We wouldn't want to jeopardize that and use any kind of state funding for any type of operating revenue for NPR. So this is a special one-time request. And as we indicated, there are some federal matching funds that are available, but this is the request that we're seeking state funding for specifically.
Other questions for Public Radio?
This would be more towards the chair, and that would be for both of these proposals from Public TV and Public Radio. Since the governor didn't have it laid out in there, I guess I'd like to see exactly what they're asking for in a separate proposal.
Well, when we get through the governor's budget proposals, which will be fairly soon now, there are a number of bills that have been introduced, and we'll be hearing those bills and voting on them. And so you'll have the opportunity after you've had the context of hearing this. So this will be a budget division process. So you will see the proposals, and some of these organizations and entities will be back before us when the bills are before us.
Thank you.
But we gotta get an idea of what the governor's proposing first. Then we'll look at the bills, and then we'll put our proposals together.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you. And then AMPERS. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Kevin Barnes. I'm with AMPERS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations.
And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Minnesota, the AMPERS group of public radio stations, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. And I would just like to start out, before I turn it over to Kevin, by saying that you'll notice in your budget papers that the governor recommended a $100,000 increase in our equipment to reestablish our equipment grants. And this is fairly remarkable. Most governors in the last 10 years have zeroed out all of public broadcasting, and only one other governor in my history representing AMPERS, and that's 20 years, has recommended an increase for any public broadcasting, and that was Rudy Perbich a long time ago. So we were quite pleased that the governor stepped in the direction and recommended an increase for public radio in his budget recommendation. And now I'll turn this over to Kevin Barnes.
Mr. Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm very honored to be here with you today, and I'm very honored to be serving this year as president of AMPERS. And I wanted to take just a bit of time to bring you up to speed as to the nature of this organization of 12 independent public radio stations. Our organization was founded in 1972 and is made up of 12 public radio stations throughout the state of Minnesota, which touch over 300,000 listeners weekly, covers 95% of the population, and 90% of the geography of the state. The radio programming is unique, local, to those communities, largely educational, and devoted to serving underserved audiences. The programming of these stations is designed to serve audiences not generally served by commercial broadcasters. In addition, the stations have 9 translators throughout the state. The stations qualify for community service grants from the state and public radio equipment grants. Due to budget considerations, the equipment grants were not funded in the 2006-07 biennium, leading to the state of repair of equipment at the stations to deteriorate to a perilous rate. These 12 stations utilize large numbers of students and volunteers to supplement the small staffs at the stations, leading to a large amount of wear and tear on the equipment at the stations. And by that, I am talking about microphones and basic studio needs that we have at these stations. Most of our stations serve as training grounds for students, and the stations which serve the most economically disadvantaged populations are the stations impacted the most by the loss of the equipment grants in the last biennium. Also, these audiences are least able to contribute financially to the operation of the stations. We are, by and large, listener-supported public radio. Examples of some of the work of our stations here in the Twin Cities, KFAI, also known as Fresh Air Community Radio, is located on the West Bank of Minneapolis, broadcasts unique programming in 13 different languages and deeply serves the immigrant communities on the West Bank near the University of Minnesota. So when I mention 13 different languages, that is Spanish, French, roughly 6 different African languages, and other languages that are quite representative of our immigrant communities here in the Twin Cities. It provides extremely relevant public and health communications with these communities who are not yet fully conversant in English. In addition, a remarkable story is that KFAI Community Radio utilizes 150 volunteers over a month to keep their operation going. KMSU is another station in our market. They're in Mankato, and they devote a large part of their Saturday programming to being in Spanish, providing a tremendous service to the immigrant Latino population in and around the Mankato area. WTIP in Grand Marais, another independent public radio station, broadcasts to much of the Boundary Waters Canoe Wilderness area with a repeater transmitter to provide canoe groups and residents in the wilderness with emergency weather and fire warnings. This station also provides programming which is critically relevant to the Native American communities in that area. The Amper stations have a total, going into this next biennium, of $1,504,000, roughly, in current equipment needs, in addition to the cost of digital conversion over the next few years, which will total roughly $2.5 million. We have enjoyed legislative support over the past several years and wonderful support from the communities that we serve, both in the Twin Cities and throughout the state. The locally focused programming produced by these stations, and this is programming that is produced at each of these stations. We do share some programming, but we have each decided to keep our programming relevant and intensely local to serve the local communities. We feel that this service reflects the local needs and provides an incredibly valuable public service function. The legislature has provided grants for Amper's public radio stations since the late 1970s. You can go to our website at Amper's, that's amperes.org, for more information. One thing that you'll see is that the governor has recommended a $100,000 per year grant to restore the public radio station equipment grant program. Again, due to prior budget restrictions, the equipment grant program was not funded in this last biennium. And as a result, you would see if you traveled around the state to these stations, which are by and large licensed to educational institutions, that they operate on a shoestring. And this equipment budget will have a tremendous effect for our stations, and particularly in outstate stations that operate with very, very small staffs and try to serve their communities. It would also, by having this increase for our equipment grant, allow the Amper stations to make this move towards high-definition radio broadcast. This is digital conversion, which is becoming the standard for radio broadcasting as well, and we feel that our stations need to make that move over the next 2 or 3 years. So this request would help to seed that move towards digital broadcasting. Once again, I want to thank you so much for your time. I want to open up my time for questions and any other concerns or thoughts you would have about AMPRS.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. The governor's recommending $100,000 for the upgrade of equipment at 12 stations. Is that what you were seeking, or is that what the governor recommended?
That's basically what he recommended.
Yeah. How is that money going to be divided among the 12 stations? Does each one
that is equal share? Okay. Equally divided, yes.
Okay, so are some in greater need than others, or, you know, I mean, some probably more worn-out equipment? And
yeah, well, the needs are great. Sure. And as an organization, we do fundraising together at different times, and we share that as well. But from the state level, we have in the past just shared that equally with the stations.
Mr. Chairman, if I could jump in here.
Sure.
Prior to Kevin's time, when the equipment grant program first began, the stations took turns on projects because they were in really bad shape. And the AMPRS group would recommend the distribution of the equipment money in chunks in larger chunks. For instance, it didn't make sense to put up half of a transmitter tower. So, but once they went around and did a major project in each of the stations, the dollars began to be distributed equally, primarily because of a prior budget cut had reduced the amount of the equipment grants to such a small amount previously that there wasn't enough to do a big project in any station. And since that previous time, the equipment grants have been distributed equally among the stations because the dollars were not large enough to make to fund a full project.
Okay. Well, around here they usually say if it's simple, it's not fair. If it's fair, it's not simple. So, I mean, but if you divide it equally, it's simple, you know. Some station may say not fair, but at least it's simple. Okay. Any other questions on this part of the budget? Any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. And
thank you so much for your time.
And the next is Channel 6, Twin Cities Regional Cable. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Wayne Langer. I'm an outside consultant, accountant for Metro Cable Channel 6.
My name is Victor Tedesco. 20 years ago, I'd know everybody sitting there. I used to be a city councilman in St. Paul for 21 years. And also in broadcasting, first owner of KDWB.
When it was WISK.
And WISK.
You're surprised I know that, huh?
Yeah, and then it was WCOW.
WCOW, COW, yes.
Are you from South St. Paul?
I'm from the Twin Cities. I grew up listening to KDWB, so. Okay. Channel 63, sorry.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I'm the chairman of the board at Channel 6. Channel 6, we're asking for the least money of anybody that's been before you. We have political broadcasting, television. We have religious broadcasting. We play some old-time music. We play big bands. We seem to fill a void, and we kind of look at ourselves as poor brothers and sisters to Channel 2. We covered a 7-state area. We have a choice location on the dial. And every dollar we earn, except the few dollars we get from you, we earn ourselves selling time. It's the same as a commercial organization. We have to go out and sell time. We have a very productive staff. We have only 2 full-time employees. The rest, there's about 15 that do their own programs, produce their own programs, and we are asking $17,500. We used to get 25, but we got cut about 3-4 years ago. Be real nice if we could go back to the 25, but we'd be happy with the 17.5, and I guess I could extend talking. That's about it.
Okay, any questions?
Can help you?
Oh, Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as one of the original incorporators of Channel 6 in the, what must have been, 1984?
It's 20 years.
1985 or 1986. I certainly am going to support $25,000 for this very, very fine operation. And I, the biggest victory we won for Channel 6, as you know, is its place on the lineup. And that that has truly made it a public television station. And there were lots and lots of attempts to move it into the double digits.
Yeah.
And we held out, and I think it's a credit to all the people who have devoted so many years to Channel 6 that it has remained there. So I'd like to congratulate you on that.
I was in the broadcasting business for 26 years, and Fonda, if any of you are familiar, not much stability. A lot of people running from one place to another. When we had our little station in South St. Paul, we had a guy move to Yakima, Washington, I believe that how you said it, and he got a $5 a week raise. So I guess what I want to say is Gay Jacobson, if you're familiar with her name, she has been with the channel since day one, and she sells all the time. And then we have a full-time engineer. Otherwise, it's all part-time help. And people that really produce. You don't stay around much without producing. And I see the only person I know on the board is here, Sandy Pappas. Mm-hmm. Nice to see you.
Hi, Vic.
So that's it, guys and ladies. I've been retired for 20 years, and I've been on this board for quite a while, and I like to pitch in. None of us are paid. Any questions?
I don't know if there's any. Let me just, I'm reminded of a story, though, when you talked about your previous work in radio. The week that KDWB went on the air, they were 6:30 on the AM dial,
right?
And they were the second rock and roll station. The first one was WDGY, which was 11:30, currently mm-hmm. KFAN. The week that they went on the radio, KDWB bought airtime on WDGY, promoting what they called Formula 63. And of course, WDGY ran those ads, not knowing that they were now promoting the new competitor. You know, and they figured it out after a few days that they were promoting that there was a new radio station, Formula 63. Nobody, you know, try Formula 63. What was KDWB advertising on WDGY? So they it was just one of those fun things that happened.
And they played Charlie Brown all day,
yeah,
over and over, the same record, and everybody was complaining. And I thought, what a way to promote a station! But they knew what they were doing. They became number one. So,
there you go. Anyway, well, thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks a lot, Mr. Tedesco.
Thank you very much for having us here.
My pleasure. Thank you. And then the last thing we have today
Mr. Chair?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Olsen.
Olsen. I'm sorry. I didn't see. Okay.
I think I must have misread that the amperes, they're actually, it's a $100,000 increase. Is that correct? Because this pie chart on page 87 shows them at 574,000. Is that? Am I reading that right?
Yeah.
Mr. Lundy?
Yeah. Yes. The base budget is 574,000 for the biennium, and then the governor is actually giving them 100,000 a year, which is $200,000 increase. So it would be 774,000 for the biennium.
Thank you.
Okay. We have the CAP board. They took us on the tour earlier, but they didn't really get involved into some of the details on some of their requests for funding, and so we asked them. And they have their own part of the budget books. Yeah. It says CAAPB. Yeah. Let's see. Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. And both, Senator Rest is on it, and Senator Pappas, this is in her legislative district area. And it's not just the capital, as I think they'll explain to us. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and also staff members. Thank you very much for allowing us to come today and talk about our biennial budget. My name is Nancy Stark. I am the Executive Secretary of the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. We are often referred to as the CAP Board, so it makes it short and easier to say. I have Mr. Paul Mandel with me today. Paul is our principal planner at the board. He is also our zoning administrator. And now, if you don't mind, for some of you who may not know about the CAP Board, we were created in 1967 by the legislature as a small non-cabinet agency with great responsibility and oversight in the Capital District. Per Minnesota Statute 15B, our mission is to preserve and the historical and architectural integrity of the Capital Area. We administer all zoning and design rules for approximately 60 blocks around our magnificent Capitol building. And through the board's comprehensive plan, we establish a flexible framework for growth within the Capitol complex. And we try to keep the buildings within the same design of Cass Gilbert, who designed this magnificent building. The agency consists of four staff: an architect, a planner, a fiscal officer, and an administrative assistant. We service a board of 10, including two legislators, three architectural advisors, and we are chaired by the Lieutenant Governor. And as Senator Betzel said, we have the pleasure of Ann Rest being reappointed to our board. This biennium, we have been involved in over 100 zoning issues. We have issued zoning permits for three new state office buildings, and we have four memorials on the Capitol Mall in all phases of design and construction. We have been co-chairs of district task forces, namely those involved with the Central Corridor and the LRT, and also the recent downtown development strategy. We are coordinators of the 2005 Commission, and since 2001, we're working with its chair and 14-member board. And very recently, as many of you know, we were collaborating with the Department of Administration and the Historical Society on the capital budget request for this building's restoration. And I might add that all of this was done as we have been operating as a part-time state agency.
When did you go from part-time, from full-time to part-time?
We went to part-time in 2003, at the end of 2003 and the beginning of 2004.
Part-time means what?
I mean, part-time. I will go on with my testimony a little bit here.
Sure.
A quick review of our base budget and for the history. In 2003, the CAP Board had its base budget reduced by over 20%, which carried over for the past two biennia, to the present day. Due to the nature and volume of the Board's work and the passion for the work that we do, we immediately reduced our hours when this budget constraint happened, and we reduced our salaries by 10 to 20%. For us, this meant that the board meetings were limited. We built very large agendas and yet had fewer meetings. We have put all new equipment on hold. Our website for public access couldn't be updated. We have had no employee development for 5 years, and our employees have paid at times out of pocket for business and agency expenses. So we come to you today with three budget initiatives that we are requesting for 2008-09 biennium. The first being an adjustment to the agency's base of $110,000 per year of the biennium. And I will ask Paul to brief you on our second and our third budget initiatives.
Paul. Welcome to the Budget Division.
Please thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record. Paul Mandel, Principal Planner for the CAP Board. The second initiative is for an update of our comprehensive plan and zoning ordinance. By state statute, we have to update this, as do any of your municipalities in the metropolitan area, every 10 years, when it was last done in 1998. We are asking for $65,000. The governor did not see fit to grant us this, and the net result is if we cannot get to our an update for our zoning and comp plan, we would risk being out of compliance with that state statute by the year 2008. The $65,000 breaks down for the comprehensive plan update, which we had a consultant service through an RFP back in the late 90s, and a complete update of our zoning ordinance, which was handled internally by our office because of the due to the cost limitations back in 98. We would have a consultant come in and do a complete, thorough exam of our zoning ordinance, updating that, working with the City of St. Paul Department of Administration. Because we're a state agency, we have to go through Administrative Procedures Act. It's not the simple matter where we hold several public hearings.
So just for members, you have a booklet from the CAP Board on page 5. They have preliminary budget initiatives. So you're saying that the $220,000 is recommended by the governor, but the $65,000 is not? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, the $220,000 was not recommended by the governor in total.
Okay, got it. Okay, so.
The governor did not support the request for $65,000, and if his direction was for us to handle that internally, and if we did try to handle that internally, we'd basically eat up the only increase he is recommending for our agency, so we'd still be, we'd probably be worse off for the wear. So it is imperative if we are to follow and to adhere to state law with regards to this 10-year renewal that we have to get busy within the next biennium. It's a one-time only comprehensive plan and zoning update that has to go through Administrative Procedures Act, State Register, and a number of publications in the State Register. The third item is supported by the governor. For the past three bienniums, we've had the language that allows us, back in 93, with regards to LRT and other planning efforts in our 60-block area, the CAP Board was allowed to charge for those extraordinary circumstances where we're doing work outside of our normal purview. And then for the past three bienniums, they have written, the legislature has seen fit to write into laws the permission or the capability for the CAP Board to hold and keep that money in its account rather than put it back into general fund. This year, we were successful in convincing the governor to actually put that into our statute so it would be a permanent condition. This usually results in about somewhere between $3,000 to $5,000 to $8,000 a year that the agency can recoup, and it helps, especially when we're in such when we're so tight on budgeting. And the governor is supporting that change, so that would be a statutory change to 15B.
Okay. We have a handout that we'd like to share with you folks. And as Paul's getting it ready, the first page is just pretty much a summary of what I read in the beginning here. And the second page is what I would call your attention to. On the second page, we have itemized our three requests and then have also recorded the governor's recommendation for the biennium. And to the item one that I spoke earlier, the governor is advocating $62,000 over the course of the biennium be added to our base budget, with a fairly typical, I think, agency-wide 2% inflation increase. And for us, that would be $15,000, set aside in another account in the Office of Enterprise Technology is $10,000 that the governor is suggesting for our website upgrade and maintenance. Total then is $87,000 for the biennium. And as Paul said, for item number two, the governor is not recommending this change to our comprehensive plan and update of our zoning. The assumption is that that work, the $65,000, can be assumed in the money that he has added to the base budget. And, of course, item number three has no monetary appropriation to it, but he is recommending yes, and we are very pleased at that. So the question is, does this restore us to a full-time operating state agency to be able to accomplish the things that we absolutely need to do? And item two is something that we absolutely need to do. No, this does not allow us to be a full-time agency and assume our other work and assume all of the work that we have at the Capitol building. As an agency with great oversight and involvement in the Capitol building restoration, the CAP board does not foresee this responsibility being conducted by a part-time Minnesota state agency. So I'm prepared, and Paul is prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Again, part-time means you're closed Fridays, is that what it is? Or
part-time
what?
Means that we would probably, to be flexible for the increases, we know we will have rent increases over the biennium. We will have land increases for the equipment. We will also have benefits, which are going to be increased. And to plan for all of that, we stay flexible that we have either 64 or 72-hour pay periods. And that means a reduction of at least 10 to 20% of our wages. Mm-hmm. So at times, we have taken one day off per week, and at times, we've taken 2 days off per month.
And how many full-time people do you have for your...
Four. Okay. We could operate with five full-time by statute, but 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago, we reduced that number when a person retired from our staff, and we all assumed more duties.
Are you part of the Department of Administration's SMART initiative, that is, where they try to provide some services for you? Does that help? Any savings there?
Mr. Chair, members, we just learned of this initiative when the governor's recommendation came out. The functions that admin could do for us, I believe, in terms of fiscal agent or HR, are minuscule in terms of what their involvement would be. I think the appropriation is for 2.5 staff. Our appropriation is for 3.5 staff. It doesn't seem to make sense to us that admin pick up those tasks for us. We have many other ways that we share efficiencies with admin. We're located in the same building with them. We maintain our LAN connections through their servers. We also share in some of their equipment purchasing programs for our computers. Those are the ways and the best ways that we share the efficiencies with administration.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I am a little confused about your comprehensive plan update, which is required by the Met Council, right? Is your plan then incorporated into the St. Paul City Council plan, or what happens exactly, and are we serving a benefit for St. Paul if we're doing a fairly significant section of their city in our comprehensive plan that we're submitting?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, back when the agency was first established, we had some of the zoning and comp plan work under the City of St. Paul, but because of the desires established within our mission statement, our zoning, our comp plan is much more rigid and tight with regards to things like billboards and height guidelines, et cetera. So after a few years, the legislature saw fit to put that responsibility back in our agency. We cooperate with the City of St. Paul, as well as the Department of Administration. Their zoning documents, if you go to their zoning map, have a blank area and with just a mere reference on it, C. It says C, S-E-E, C-A-A-P-B, for zoning jurisdiction. They still have all code enforcement, building code, health code, et cetera. We have the zoning authority, sign control, and et cetera. Do we do them a service? Yes. We work in cooperation with them. They have, as I don't know if it was stated, but they have the mayor has three appointed members on our board. So it's a cooperative arrangement. We have gubernatorial, mayoral, and legislative members on our board. So it's a very symbiotic and cooperative relationship. I sit on numerous task forces. Nancy mentioned them with regard to LRT and the comp plan for downtown St. Paul. I co-chaired that with a member from their planning commission. So we're sort of seen as equals in that sense. Does that answer your question? I don't know.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, how big land-wise is the area that you have control over for the comprehensive planning?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, our boundaries go from the far side of Sears on Marion Street. You'd find this on page 2, I believe, or 3 in our biennial report. It goes from the back side of Sears on Marion, right in the median of Marion Street, up to the Pennsylvania Arch, which is along the industrial park on the north side of the north side where the Pira building is and such, over to Jackson Street and comes down between the state properties and Regents Hospital, across the freeway to the frontage road of 11th Street, and then five blocks in the downtown, over to the History Center and back up just shy of the cathedral, and then over to Marion Street again.
Chair.
Rolling.
I'm just trying to figure out costing out a comp plan for a comparably sized city or something. You obviously don't have much residential in here at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we have about 20 blocks of residential all totaled, and commercial, if you will. Because of our unique district, it's a much, like I said, our charge is to protect, enhance, and improve the beauty, dignity, and architectural integrity of the Capitol. So it's a much more comprehensive. The comparability would be much more to a historic district or a special design district. We're modeled somewhat after Washington, D.C., with a Capitol precinct. Our height guidelines, for instance, prohibit any buildings taller than the Capitol cornice, so that the Capitol is viewed from throughout the Capitol city. So it's a lot more comparable to that than it is to any municipality per se. More of an overlay district, if you will, but we have zoning authority, complete zoning authority.
Other questions? So we'll see.
When it's my understanding there's like $1 million grant for looking at developing the, or there's grant money for looking at the capital improvement and. When we went on the tour, where's that funded from? Let me rephrase that.
No, I know. Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I think you're talking about the schematic design work that was in the capital bonding request from and approved last year. That is covering, I believe, about 65%. It'll be exhausted before the end of the session, actually, for the schematic work toward the restoration of the interior of the building. That's under our capital budget that was approved last year.
Do you get a percentage of that for the cap board, or you don't?
I can answer that,
Ms. Stark.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have the opportunity with the language that came about in the last two bienniums, three actually, that we can bill for projects within the capital district. We bill those according to the board per diems, which is $55 a day or meeting, and we also then do hourly wages on staff, and primarily it's Paul and my time. And I believe the average of what our billable is over a year's period of time is somewhere in the range of about $8,000. That is what you will find in the governor's recommendation or the governor's report. But yes, we do, because this is within the Capital District. We can bill for a significant time on the capital project.
Thank you. Other questions? There's to be none. Okay. Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, just to reiterate what Ms. Stark spoke to, the governor in his recommendations intended, and I believe he stated his intention to bring us back to full time. The problem lies in that by not funding our comp plan and zoning ordinance, we basically would eat up all that increase with the work that we're required to do by state law. So we would, in effect, be at a no net gain, unfortunately.
Have you pointed this out to the governor's office? He'll be submitting a supplemental budget recommendation after the next forecast. If his intentions didn't quite match the numbers, you know, perhaps he might adjust that the next time around. I mean, we won't know until he releases that, but have you at least contacted the office and pointed that out to him?
Mr. Chair and members, we were not aware of this, but thank you for the advisement on it. Yes, I would. I think it's certainly imperative that we at least begin item two to update our comp plan and our zoning upgrade this biennium and this coming year.
Okay. Well, again, I'd recommend that you at least pass that on to the governor's office so that if his intention was to get you back to full funding, you'd say, yeah, but it didn't happen. You know, maybe they can address that so we've got some different numbers to look at when that's released.
Budget.
So, a supplemental budget, yeah. So, Robling.
It does strike me, though, that if we're kind of like a historic district, there can't be too much change in a comp plan. Do you anticipate a lot of changes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the comp plan, as I said earlier, this was the first time since 1982 that we had redone the comp plan, so we purposely had a consultant come in to do the majority of the work. Our zoning ordinance, as a result, got short shrift, and that is where most of the changes are. With all the changes that are occurring in zoning law, the 60-day rule, the new technologies today, all the difference in everything from satellite technology, antennas, and all the cell towers, et cetera, we were not able to do a thorough and exhaustive rework of our zoning ordinance because of the amount of time that takes. And you have to, as part of our zoning ordinance, you have to write what they call a sonorous statement of need and reasonableness, which becomes exhaustive. And we were limited by the amount of time and money we had left. So that's where the predominance and preponderance of the amount of work will be dedicated this time would be to tightening up our zoning ordinance relative to condo conversions, things like that. So.
And I think Senator Rust had been telling me about how you were trying to do, there were some issues on billboards over here near the Sears property, and then this parking ramp that Regents Hospital is being, right. And all that requires CAP board approval and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff that goes around here that you folks get involved in. So, anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Wednesday, we're going to be looking at the Minnesota Department of Finance budget and the Attorney General's budget. And if you start looking through what's left in the tabs of the briefing books, we're going to be hitting some of the big agencies, the legislative budget, the governor's office, and so forth. And as Senator Olsen asked earlier, there are some bills that have been introduced, and we'll start looking at those, too, and voting on them as we start preparing our share of the budget here. So. If nothing further, then meeting's adjourned. Thank you.